Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm joined in the studio by Rusty again. How are you doing today?
Doing well. How are you, Doug?
I'm doing awesome. Good to have you in the studio. And today, we're talking about one of my favorite topics, one of your favorite topics, food. So we're going to talk about food and cooking and our approach to eating, maybe, just overall. But we did have a listener send in a request for this topic, and I was very excited because I literally could do a whole podcast, a whole show just on this, because food takes up like 80% of my mental bandwidth and like probably 50% of the time. So I thought you'd be perfect to talk about this, Rusty.
I feel like every time we get together, we always end up talking about like what we're going to eat, or like even in advance of it, like texting about what we're going to eat and things like that. Like, I've known for a week that I'm going to be getting chili at your house today. So, and then, yeah. And then a lot of the conversation on the hike is like pizza or beers, yeah, or, you know, things like that.
And the funny thing, especially on hikes, I find that after about 40% of the hike, I start talking about food because I'm starting to get hungry. So we'll cover a few different topics. I'm going to lay out a bit of a map for you today. It should be mostly in this kind of order, but we'll see how it goes. Number one, our food origin story, just like why we're so into food. We'll talk about inspiration, where we get some of our ideas. Because I think, you know, Rusty and I, we cook at home. I don't know, 80% of the meals we have are probably at home.
At least, yeah. Yeah.
We'll talk about equipment a little bit. Of course, cost. We may move that up. We'll try to make it somewhat related to FI, or at least some of the ideas we'll transfer over. We'll talk about our style of cooking, our use of recipes, and maybe a little bit about the time and effort that we do put in. One thing I want to jump ahead to, my stomach is growling just talking about the food. So I was thinking about a hike that we went on near Breckenridge area, and you made these very delicious sandwiches. Can you tell us what was in there?
Okay. Yeah, I didn't anticipate when I was making the sandwiches that they'd become a potential talking point, but backing up, I was, you know, obviously being out here in Colorado doing a lot of hiking, and I was bringing just those pre-packaged bars that are pretty standard. Mm-hmm. And I just stepped back for a moment and thought about that. And I was like, I don't really eat like this any other time. Like, why does the hike have to be any different than any other meal? And so I've started to try to do some more gourmet things when I hike. So the time you were up there, it was like September, maybe, or August. Was it August? Anyways.
Yeah. Late July. It was a beautiful day. It started to cool off in the mountains.
Got it. But a lot of that summer produce was in season. And so I was at the store, and there were figs. I was there with my son, and there were like perfect black figs. My son wanted to get some, and he said he really wanted to make jam, like homemade jam with them. And I love that as a four-year-old, that's where his mind was at. That just gives you an idea for how much we're talking about food at our house. And so I was like, let's think about that. And so the blackberries were really good too. We made a jam out of that. And then you were coming up. So I was like, how do we turn this into something gourmet that would work for the hike? So got a couple loaves or a couple baguettes, sliced those in half, made a sandwich, got like nice ham, brie, arugula, some lemon juice, mayonnaise, and mustard, and then put the jam on the top, the mayonnaise mustard on the bottom, and made a sandwich, wrapped them in tin foil, put them by the cold water bottle in the hiking backpack. Yeah. And yeah, we got to sit on top, or not on top of the mountain, but up in the mountains by an alpine lake, eating these really, apparently were awesome, good sandwiches. You still want to talk about them. So
yeah, that's one of the tricks on a hike, is like you could bring a PB&J on white bread, and it's like, whoa, that is really, really good.
That's hitting.
But that one, that was super memorable. Also knowing like it was homemade jam and like super fresh and like all that kind of stuff, like it adds to the experience overall. And I think, I mean, some of the themes are around like the mindfulness and like the shopping, picking out the stuff that's good at the store that day. And we'll get into this. So that was not exactly a recipe, but it highlights like the approach we often take. Now, we're going to have chili after we finish recording. And I made this chili, I'm trying to remember. I made it like a week ago, but I put it in the freezer because I knew we weren't going to have it right away. So I was like, I'll throw it in the freezer just to make sure we don't get sick after eating it, right? So it should be fine. Anyway, I typically don't use a recipe, especially for something like chili. So in this case, I used, I don't know, it was like roughly lean meat. So it's ground beef in there and nothing super fancy. The main thing that I want to talk about for chili is using like whole dried peppers.
I was hoping you were going to say that. Yeah. I was going to ask, and then it's going to be awkward if you're going to say use chili powder, but.
Yeah. So you can get chili powder at the store, but it's pre-ground. You don't know what's in there. It's probably mostly paprika, which is fine, but it's not exactly what you're looking for. So it's just like some random stuff that's red and you don't know when it was ground or how old it is and all that stuff. And if you go to a normal grocery store, you'll see a ton of, if you go to the Mexican section, you should see a bunch of like dried peppers and different varieties. And it ranges from mild to very hot. And I think, I can't even remember the ones that I put in there, but maybe like New Mexico, something on the milder side. And then a couple of those dried peppers from a hotter variety. Again, I'm not even sure. I just know I have like a variety that I could blend together. Yep. Typically, you'll take the seed out, you take the membrane out, rehydrate it, usually in like a beef broth or something like that. And then you use that instead of the you know, dried pre-ground powder and all that stuff. And other than that, you know, you do kind of the normal things that you put in chili, although a couple things that I do put in there. So cumin, of course, I'll use smoked paprika, bring out a little smoke flavor. And I'll usually put a little chocolate, a little cinnamon, a little nutmeg, and not enough to be able to taste, but it's just for complexity or whatever. I wave the jar near the, the bowl. But it's kind of like, it adds complexity and maybe like a little of the mole idea.
Yeah.
So any observations on that?
That's exactly what I was going to say. Okay. Especially we were just in Oaxaca this past year where they have, it's like the birthplace of mole and also one of the birthplaces of chocolate too. But the way you described it, I was like, oh, you have all the essential components of a mole there. So that's
okay.
But yeah, if someone is listening to this and they've never made chili with real dried chilies instead of chili powder, it's just,
it's a total thing.
Total game changer. Yeah.
Yeah.
I said, oh, we aren't making as much chili because, you know, our son doesn't want to eat spicy food. And they're like, oh, you could just make it without the chilies. I was like, I don't even, like, that's not even, that's like tomato soup. That's not, you can't call that like even chili in my mind.
Yeah. 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 And then the one other thing that I added in this last batch was we had like some pre-cooked smoked sausage from like a barbecue place. Mm. We just had like one link and I was like, you know what? I'll dice this up and throw it in. So there's only a couple pieces, but it did add like another layer of like smokiness and just meaty complexity. So
just even one ingredient like that too, especially if it's smoked, you know, something like that just adds a whole nother kind of depth to the flavor.
So, and this is what we usually talk about when we're hiking.
we'll try not to just go off now on different things that we've cooked and eaten before.
Yeah. Especially like, I'm only going to make it like 30 minutes and I'm like, all right, we got to go upstairs and eat. But, okay, let's get into the food origin story. So Rusty, what's your earliest memories of food or however you want to tell us this story?
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't think about it that way. But one really early memory I have is I was like toddler in Cleveland, Ohio, and they have this market that is like now like sometimes on food cooking shows. It's featured. It's called, I think it's called like West Side Market or like West End Market or West Market, something like that. But it's one of those actual like old markets that's still intact and has different stalls with food vendors and has been around for 100 plus years. And I still have a very distinct memory of going there. And they had one stall that would make you fresh nut butters. And my mom just like got us the fresh peanut butter that was like freshly ground in front of us. And I just remember eating it and it tasting so good. And it's probably, because we moved from Cleveland when I was four. So that's probably one of my like earliest memories. But yeah, unfortunately, most of my childhood was the food scene was pretty bleak. I grew up in Iowa, you know, probably like the 90s were my prime period. And so there was a lot of like Hot Pockets, a lot of Pizza Hut, things like that. And then, you know, school lunches were so miserable. But then luckily around the time I graduated from college is the time when the Food Network was getting like really good. And that was also the first time that I was kind of on my own cooking wise, didn't have parents cooking for me or relying on school food. So yeah, so started to really cook and learn how to cook there. And then that became, within like a few months of moving to Houston, just cooking became my biggest hobby and obsession, and would watch Food Network almost every day. And we had inadvertently moved to an apartment that was like a block and a half away from the biggest farmers market in Houston. And so started learning more about seasonality and ingredients and going to the farmers market almost every weekend. Yeah. So, yeah, those were kind of the big inflection points. And then the other big one was when we moved to Chicago. There's such a diverse food scene there. There's, you know, some of the like highest rated Michelin starred restaurants in the world that they tend to be like super innovative in Chicago too. And then there's every type of cuisine you could imagine having. So like, I honestly didn't even know where Indonesia was on a map. And then it was like, there were two Indonesian restaurants on our street and they were amazing and so good. And I was like, anyways, now I know where Indonesia is on a map, but food was kind of the way that got introduced. How about you? What was your childhood like with food or early food memories, I guess?
Yeah. After I asked you that and you were like, oh, I'll have to think. I was like, you know what? I don't remember exactly either. So I'll have to.
I can fill with another childhood memory that just came to mind is the Iowa State Fair. It's kind of touted as one of the best state fairs, but I remember as a kid going there, getting like pork chop on a stick, one of those big turkey legs, and then they, you know, they deep fat fry all that stuff. Oh, so yeah. I remember very distinctly having deep fat fried butter, having deep fat fried Oreos and being excited. I mean, that's not, you know, I don't think that's like the best food, but I do think that's like a really great culinary experience to go to a fair and just have food be super celebrated.
Yeah. I'll have to think back on the very earliest memory, and maybe I probably won't remember it. I'll think of it in days, but I'm half Filipino, and at least as I see it, the Filipino culture is very food oriented. There's a lot of like parties and get togethers. So that definitely was like early on, just like big extended family and having like some of the Filipino dishes mixed in on the same table with a Thanksgiving meal. There's like normal turkey stuffing, cranberry sauce, and then you have like lumpia, pancit, chicken adobo, other stuff like that, where it's just like normal to have all that together. Lots of memories were like my mom cooking those dishes, working, you know, all day on some of the stuff. And then my dad also cooked quite a bit also. He was a firefighter, and firefighters are famously good cooks often. They have time and usually a really nice industrial kitchen. So, and for me, the kids, we were able to learn from him as well, because they often have like an odd schedule where maybe they work for 24 hours, but they're off for 2 days or whatever it is in your locality. So anyway, some early memories were like how to make like scrambled eggs and like just, you know, crack some eggs and do some stuff, and pancakes, like other simple things, apparently breakfast related.
Yep.
And then there were a couple other highlights. So one, exactly like you said, I'm a few years older than you, but essentially Hot Pockets, ramen was like one of the first things like I learned to cook, and my parents would let me. I feel like I was only like five or six, so pretty young to fire up the stove and all that, learn how to make like hot dogs in the microwave, some essential things like that. But Pizza Hut, still one of my favorites to this day. And even not that great pizza is like, it's pretty good.
Pretty good, yeah.
It's pretty good pizza. And then I know Carl always asks, like, what Chicago style of pizza is your favorite?
Oh, man. Well.
Let's get into it, yeah.
That could send me down a whole rabbit hole. But there's a lot of diversity of pizza in Chicago, which is great. The big debate is the deep dish versus the tavern style. And we definitely ate tavern style more frequently, but we would do the deep dish when people would come in from out of town. Yeah, I wouldn't classify those as either of my favorite pizzas in Chicago. But there's one place that's still around called Bonchi. That's Roman style, and they have these big sheets of pizza, and they take scissors and they cut off however much you want. And the guy was on like Chef's Table on Netflix for his Roman style pizza, and this was the first place. Chicago was the first place he opened outside of Italy. So when that opened, I was like, this is really freaking good. Wow. That was before he was on Netflix or anything, but yeah, did that. And then there was another place where, I mean, the myth of this restaurant, it was Pizzeria Babu, and the myth was that the guy was like financially independent and he just wanted to make really awesome pizzas. And for a while, there was like a 2-year period where he was open, and then he closed like right away during COVID, even though I think pizza businesses were actually doing pretty well during COVID, but he decided he didn't want to do it. But there was like this 2-year period where people would be like, where do you want to go? Like, we're going to get together. Where do you want to go? I was like, let's go to Pizzeria Babu. That's like,
that's the place to go.
Yeah, that's like the best pizza in Chicago.
Very good.
Yeah.
So I also love the Food Network, but being a couple years older than you and just having like, a food interest, I remember watching some of the food shows on like PBS and stuff.
Yeah.
So like Justin Wilson and like Yan Can Cook. You remember that guy? Yan, I forget his last name. So yeah,
Lydia's Kitchen or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Lydia Bastianich. Yeah.
So some of the stuff that was coming on before we had cable, before we had Food Network and stuff. And I was like, oh, this is pretty fun. I'll watch this. And I was, you know, under 10 at that point. And then, kept watching. I think there were more shows before Food Network like rolled out and everything. But yeah, I was in college and just started watching like the Food Network constantly at that point too. And we just went to a show earlier this year, Alton Brown of Good Eats. He was one of my favorites and mixed together some of our favorite things, like you and I both, where it's like Monty Python and Julia Child. And what was it? There's a third piece of the formula. Like he wanted to educate and entertain and be funny, but I forget the third piece. But it fit perfectly because it wasn't too serious. Some of the PBS shows were a little stuffy and he was a little nerdy and sciencey, which I enjoyed as well. So it was like, why are you doing this stuff? Right. Not just a prescription, a list of items to mixed together.
Yeah, hit that Good Eats was really transformational. And then that was around the same time that I started paying attention to America's Test Kitchen, which, you know, both of them, they don't just tell you the recipe, they explain the technique, they give you the underlying rationale for why you're doing things a certain way. And they tell you, they're like, oh, these modifications you might think would make the dish better, but we tested them and they don't work. And here's the reason why. So super helpful to get some actual analysis into like cooking entertainment. Right. And I feel like that's one of the big things that Alton Brown brought.
Yep. So I want to switch over to the FI related idea here, and that's cost. So one of the things is if you cook at home, you often save a lot of money, even if you get like premium ingredients. And for me, it's a pastime. Like I said, I really do think about food all the time. Like what meal is coming next? Yep. Elizabeth comes to me like, hey, what should I eat for lunch today? Cause I have a good handle of like leftovers, which is an essential piece of how I approach our meals and meal planning. I don't really think of it as meal planning. It's just, it's a lifestyle for me. But like, I know what we have and roughly how many meals. So all that to say, I actually don't keep track very much of like how much we're actually spending on food. Mm-hmm. It fits within our budget and I don't care to like itemize things. It's not going to change how I'm doing things, but you have more insight on your cost of food and groceries and eating out and how that's changed over time. So I'll send it to you and let you tell us about it.
Well, I mean, when we were more in the like accumulation stage, that's when we were more keeping tight track of it. Now, yeah, we're much more in your boat, but we did have a phase where I was super cost conscious. And in fact, I mean, it was basically, especially like those last couple years before retirement, it was the number one criteria that I was buying food on was just like, how do we make things as cheap as possible? Which for someone who enjoys food is not maybe the best way to approach things. We were at more like $5,000 a year was our food spending. And now it's roughly around like $25,000 a year. Okay. So huge increase. That's for like a few reasons. I think inflation has been really real at the grocery store in particular. I know there's a lot of like headlines and things about that, but for the most part, it's like, we're basically buying the same things that we were before, but the price has gone up significantly. But then when we were in that accumulation phase, I was keeping track of the prices at Aldi and Costco and knowing which stores had better prices on certain products and buying the products at which store was cheaper and then strategically alternating between Costco and Aldi on different days. So it's a strategy. It's a strategy for wealth accumulation. I don't think that's like the funnest way, funnest way to approach food.
Quick clarification. Yeah. So it went up from about 5,000 to 25,000.
Oh yeah.
You said inflation is impacted, but it wasn't from the
25,000. That wouldn't explain the whole thing. Yeah. So I think we had a kid, so that's an extra person to feed. I think the other things that drove that is like we shop at Whole Foods now more. We aren't just trying to buy like just the cheapest things. We shop based on health. We'll buy organic and we'll get whatever type of meat that we want and we'll get seafood more frequently and things like that. It's all, and then, you know, another part of it is like now that we're like retired, we have more time to cook for people and we will have people over and cook more. So I think we're feeding more people with our cooking than even just the three of us. So yeah, all that led to the increase. I would not say the 5,000 to 25,000 is just driven by the inflation, but yeah, so that is where we're at. And it's interesting too, because to go from being so conscious about the price of food to really not caring, because the 25,000, I think to an older version of me would seem like an outrageous number. And I'd be like, here's 1,000 ways that you could cut down that number. And now I'm like, you know what? This is perfectly within our spending. We're happy with the food that we're eating. We're much healthier than we were previously. And we value our health. And to the extent we have extra money to spend, I think that's a good place to be spending it. I justify it to myself too. I'm like, we're still cooking at home. We're still doing some very conscious things with like our lifestyle around food. But the cost has essentially skyrocketed. But I'm also like, you know, we have extra money to spend and that's where we want to spend it.
It's close to some of the ideas from Die with Zero and people talking about like a value-based approach where sure, you could save money, you could optimize on cost with food, but is that the best way to do it? Depending on where you are in your journey or if you care about food, some people are like, I don't want to fucking cook. And they're like, they don't care about it. But when we're thinking about like how valuable it is to have good food that you're putting in your body and you're like healthier because of it and you feel better, it's like, what else would you spend money on? Like, it doesn't... The cost is definitely worth it. So there's a lot of ways to restate that. But yeah, it's like a very valuable thing because it probably is leading you to be more healthy.
Yep. And I think the healthy, and then, you know, like for us, it's such a source of joy. People like us, where it's like, I literally am like finishing a meal and I'm like, oh, what am I going to eat for the next meal? Or, you know, what am I going to eat tomorrow? I'm thinking about that pretty much constantly. So it's my primary hobby in terms of how I spend my time. And it's probably one of the most important things you could do, you right. know, for your health. So, yeah.
Yes. So closely related to the cost is leftovers. I grew up, leftovers are awesome. Like I have no issue with it. Some folks, they're like, I don't eat leftovers and I don't quite get it, but some things are actually better as leftovers. So quick example, I made some roast and that's one of those. Chili is actually better leftover.
Yeah. Any soups or stews. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Do you know, is there an enzyme or something where like if it's cooled down and reheated, I can't remember. It was in one of Alton's books, but yeah. I can't remember.
Okay. If there's a scientific answer, I don't know. But I would just say unscientifically, like the flavors have time to meld. So marinate. Yeah.
Perfect. Whoever knows, send us an email or leave a comment in there. I'm sure someone smart knows the exact thing that's going on. So leftovers, totally fine. One of the things that I do, partly because I enjoy it, but it turns out it's also economical. I'll buy like a lot of meat at Sam's or Costco or wherever and cook all of it, even though there's only two of us eating. But it's much easier to fire up the grill and cook 10 pounds of meat, or it's about the same effort to do 10 pounds of meat as it is to do like two or something right. like that.
Yep.
And, or I mean, if it doesn't make sense to me to just cook like whatever you're eating right then, very rarely. So anyway, I'll cook a lot of meat and then there'll be some for leftovers. I label it. It's like a restaurant basically. So label it with masking tape, put what it is and the date. I'll freeze some of it. We have a vacuum sealer. I use it all the time. And like you could vacuum seal the meat, throw it in the freezer and it'll be good for whatever, 6 months. And on a day where I'm like, why don't I just get out this meat that I cooked a couple months ago? It's good to go. So that saves a huge amount of time. And it's kind of fun to fire up the grill. The grill stays hot for whatever, several hours.
Right.
So you may as well just like cook on it for a few hours, have a beer out there. It's fun. So any thoughts on leftovers?
Along a similar line, I think when we plan, like, or when I'm at the grocery store kind of planning and shopping, I'll kind of think in terms of, you know, what ingredients or what things can I make multiple meals out of so that it's not just always the exact same leftover. So if you're going to do, say like, tacos are sounding good, I'll be like, okay, well, I can make a big batch of whatever meat I'm going to use for the tacos. And I can also get a bunch of Mexican salad ingredients and make a salad, you know, one night and put the meat on there or do some sort of like bowl, you know, with the same meat, especially like around the protein. It's like, oh, I'll slow cook one big piece of meat, 2 or 3 pounds of it. And then you can come up with different ways to eat it. So.
Yeah. And actually thinking about it, I should have put some of the roast in the chili.
Okay.
Which we can. I can just slice some up and put it on top and we'll just stir it around. But yeah, that's another fun thing with chili is like to mix meats and have like some roast in there and some other stuff. And friend of the show, JT, he gets real upset if there's beans in there.
Okay.
So there are beans. It's from Texas, you know, whatever those guys. So there's beans in this chili as well, some black and some pintos. What's your stance on beans?
He would have been fine, but now JT's going to find out. You almost got away with it, Doug.
Yeah. He's like, what is in here?
This is not Texas red.
Yeah. Are you all right with beans?
Oh, yeah. I pretty much always put them in the chili. There's the beans in general are such a nice way to fill out a meal, too. And I mean, it's almost a cliche, right? Like eating rice and beans is the way you get to fry, but beans are so delicious and I've had so many good beans in my life. And if they're a cost effective way to get protein, why not? You know, why not use them?
There's no issue with that. Yeah. All right. So leftovers, anything else around like cost or meal planning or leftovers
I forget what the statistic is, but it's like something like 40% of food waste happens once you get home. So once you get good at leftovers or figuring out how you're going to use all your food. I mean, we just almost throw away no food at our house. Like, and Sometimes I'm like, why are people buying more food if they have food at their house that they could be using? And you figure out ways to do it, like making soups for savory, to use up extra savory stuff, or, you know, making smoothies to use up extra fruit or produce. But yeah, I mean, we just throw away almost nothing. So
yeah. Super rare for us to, we have the occasional thing, but yeah, very consistent. And then when you label everything and you have it facing out, like, right, you know, like what you need to eat, right, and when. So
I sometimes take it too far. I was like, one of the things that I felt like I needed to like cut back on was how concerned I was with food waste. Cause I like ate something this summer that made me sick. And I was like, that was not worth it. Like whatever, saving that $2 or not throwing away that one. I think it was like some sardines, but they were like expired, but I was like, oh, sardines are still fine. And then, yeah, I had like a sore throat for like a week after that. So,
man,
yeah.
Rotten sardines. That's, I don't know. Worst, it was like
that and
gross.
Yeah.
All right.
Don't torture yourself, especially when you're just trying to save the cost of a can of sardines. So,
yeah. All right. So a couple other items that I think fit in sort of the FI area. And these were things that you thought were important to mention. One is community and one is mindfulness. So I'll let you talk about each of those a little bit.
Yeah. So, I mean, cooking is just such a beautiful way to connect with people. You just even think from an evolutionary standpoint, we're the only species that evolved to eat cooked food. So there's something so primal about having food and coming together. It's also like more intimate to have people over to your house and serve them a meal there. I feel like you always get like closer connection with people doing that than meeting up at a restaurant or doing other eating at other places. Not to say that there aren't other activities, like, you know, I think like the hiking in particular is another super fun way to get to connect with people. But yeah, I think there's something that's like really special that happens when you invite someone over to your home, you cook them your food, you're all eating the same meal, eating the same food and things like that. And then with the mindfulness, I just think that's such a great skill to develop for life in general, period. But when you're cooking, if you're doing it well and you're present and in tune with it, you're using all of your senses. You can smell when things are happening, hear when they're happening. Obviously, you're tasting and seeing things a lot too. And so it's one of those like fully immersive sensory experiences. And I can be in the kitchen cooking, just not doing anything else. And I, you know, lose track of time. I'm in kind of like a meditative state and, you know, I'll like look up and it'll be like hour and a half, 2 hours have gone by. And I'm like, oh, I was in a flow state essentially. Yeah. So during that 100%. Period.
Yeah. And that has definitely, it's gotten me a couple times when Elizabeth is like, hey, when's food going to be ready? And I'm like, probably, I don't know, whatever, an hour. And then it's like 2 hours go by. I'm like, oh no, I need to get on this. So yeah, 100% with the mindfulness aspect, time goes by. Slightly related, I think you and I have spent enough time like consuming information like from the Food Network or books. We've internalized a lot of the process and we've obviously trial and error, right? I've made a lot of bad things in the past. And at this point, and I haven't ever cooked in a restaurant. I worked at a snack bar once, but it's not the same. We just reheated stuff. So at this point, like I feel pretty confident if someone just like plopped me into their house in their kitchen and there was like enough things to like make some food, like I could pull it together even with like minimal ingredients and it would be pretty good just because I've internalized the process to cook certain things and what can go together well, even with like minimal stuff. We have a friend has a lot of dietary restrictions. So it's like, you can't use even like black pepper. So I think you could use like salt, a couple herbs. And I was like, okay, I can make this work. And literally it was like baked chicken with like salt and olive oil. And it was pretty fucking good. Right. I was like, wow, like the simplest ingredients, but nothing got in the way.
There was that like phase of Food Network where they were doing all those competition shows, like Cutthroat Kitchen. And that was Alton Brown.
Hosted
that, right? Yeah. So, but I mean, that was the whole premise of the show, is like, they'd basically take away, like, you don't have a heat source. You don't have a knife, you know, we take away your main protein, in some ways, it's like, oh, what a silly premise for a show. That's so unrealistic. But it actually does get your mind like thinking, like, oh, what would you do if you didn't have like a heat source? Like, how would you cook? You know, how would you make pasta?
So, get that soldering iron out, start cooking things up. That'll come into play for the sound check. But you can't use the soldering iron that you use with the lead.
Is that right?
Okay. So very important.
Pro tip.
Pro
tip.
This is all entertainment, by the way. I'm not a cooking professional in any fashion.
I do actually have professional cooking experience now that mention it.
Because
my first job at 16 was at Dairy Queen. Oh. So I don't think you learned probably the best. It's not probably the best culinary training, but
you're like a blizzard engineer.
I think I'd be very good at cleaning out a kitchen, like wiping down every inch with like vinegar and water, because that's what we had to do every night. That would be my main skill I could bring to like a more professional kitchen.
So on the mindfulness stuff and the just being able to like cook and do things with lower effort, and this is one of the things, like, one of the challenges in our household. So I do love to cook. Elizabeth actually likes to cook a lot also, but I'm a little particular about like some of the, like, I go to Sam's and, like, again, we've internalized, you and I, Rusty, like, I'll go get a bunch of meat. I get whatever looks good that day versus like going in with a list of items for a recipe. And because of that, it's like it's a greater mental lift for her to do that. It's a little more stressful. I also deal with stress better, but that's another topic. But like, she would, I have a recipe from like America's Test Kitchen, and then she would have the list of items. So she has to go get exactly what is on that list. And then she follows the recipe, and it's more stressful than I come in casual. I'm like, oh, what kind of meat do we have? Great. Give me some salt in a hot pan and I'll make some food. So I just find it more enjoyable, and it's a little more stressful for her. All that to say, like, it's fun for us because we have the underlying skills and the foundation where we can just show up and get into the flow state.
Yep.
And it's probably one of the, you know, I'm looking at guitars and amps and I'm like, oh, like it'll be great if I can have that sort of like natural feeling when I pick up the guitar and I'm like, oh, I just pick it up and I know what to play. Like, I go to the kitchen and I know what to do.
Yeah. And I think developing that skill is, I mean, for me personally, I'd call it like a keystone habit of life. It's like you want the keys to a happy life. Like, knowing how to cook is up there with like walking, reading, like riding a bike. Like, if you do those four things and you get proficient so that you enjoy all of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think those are kind of like keystone habits. And then if you're that good with cooking too, like, yeah, you don't waste food. You can shop really strategically. You can adjust while you're at the store. You could take advantage of like a deal. If you see like a deal on a certain item, a certain grocery item. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I felt like all that actually was quite helpful on the fire journey. And then if you enjoy it too, I mean, yeah, you said 80%, like we're probably cooking more than 90% of our meals. We had, we had like a 2-month span where it's like, oh man, we ate out a lot. I was like, I'm not feeling as like, feeling like not as good about how much eating out we were doing. I went back and looked at the credit card statements and we'd eaten out 9 times in 2 months. And I was like, oh, that's just, there are a lot of Americans who are eating out 9 times in a week, you know? Right. So, yeah.
Both of us are in a great position where we have the time to cook and we don't need to eat out. And I know, I think back like how unhealthy I was. I remember like whatever, going to the office cafeteria and getting like, you know, not very healthy food, not great stuff. It's just like, like eating at a diner or cafe, like all the time, or like on the way to work, like grab some Chick-fil-A or some other stuff. Right. And just, it's not great for you. Every now and then, I still love the trashy food. Do you still?
I've tried, if I even try the trashy food, I'll be like, oh, you know, I feel like Arby's used to just really hit for me sometimes. I lived in a college where everything was closed on Sunday, but just in town, everything was closed. But just outside town, there was an Arby's. And so I'd go get it on Sundays. And I had Arby's recently and I was like,
bro, me too.
Yeah, oh my God. I was like so disappointed. So
I was driving to South Dakota. So it was like in the middle of nowhere in Wyoming or... fuck, I don't remember. High country out west, right? Yeah, it was a kind of a rough town. I won't mention it here, but it looked kind of methy, if you know what I mean. And I was like, yeah, this town has seen better days. Had an Arby's, I stopped. I got the beef and cheddar, which was my favorite. I think I even got like the extra meat on there. I'm like, oh yeah, I need my protein. I don't even know if it was meat.
That's funny. That's what I got too when I did Arby's recently.
What?
The double meat beef and cheddar with curly fries.
Yeah. And I'll put up a pic. I didn't get the fries because I was like, I want to make this a healthy meal. But I got a milk. I got the Jamocha. Anyway, I ate it and like halfway through, I was like, this does not taste like I remember that. And I took a picture. So we'll put it up on the screen for the people to be fucking horrified at what I ate. So I ate that and then like got back in the car. So it was a day of driving.
Just feeling horrible while you drive. Yeah. So maybe my experience was just specific to Arby's too.
Yep. Yeah. So. And I was like, Arby's, you can get probably the curly fries were, right? Right?
Yep.
Okay. Beef, I'm not sure it's beef. Yeah. It's like the sludge or whatever they use. Other places, Wendy's is often a go-to on road trips. Mm-hmm. Typically, it's road trips. And when I have it, I'm like, this is not that bad. Once every 6 months or whatever. So
yeah.
Okay. As we are winding it down a little bit, we have a few more items we want to get into. So we talked a little bit about our style of cooking and it sounds like we both get in a flow state. Let's talk about recipes. So I actually have a lot of cookbooks and many of them are filled with recipes, but I have a certain approach and I don't want to go on a big rant, but obviously the internet is a very important development over the last 30 years. And recipe websites are just fucking horrible. I hate them. So it degraded.
But how do you really feel, Doug?
It degraded over time because it's like the rest of the internet. Like at one point it was like people sharing stuff. And then one of the biggest issues now is you pop over to a site, ads will start popping up. And most of us are on our phone, right? So like ads pop up, autoplay video. So there's ads. And I don't really like that anyway. The other issue is there's a strong chance the person didn't even make the dish and they don't know what they're talking about. They're doing SEO writing. And, you know, I had time in the SEO world and websites and all that. So I understand what they're trying to do, but it ended up just being a horrible transition to recipe websites that are virtually useless because either the recipes aren't that good, the people didn't make them. Now there's probably AI regurgitations of the same recipes. And it turns out there's no ads in books. Right. So you could open it. And they went through an editing process, usually very complicated, and they tested the recipes.
Yep.
And I know there are some recipe websites that do that, but few and far between in a book is a great way to like get information. So
definitely if you're just Googling, I feel like if you have an idea for a dish you want to make and you Google the name of the recipe, like say it's whatever, chili or something like that, I feel like the recipes that come up, you have to sift through them for so long where you're much better off just having like a cookbook on the shelf that you know has been tested, that you can trust, you know, going and pull that off. I think, you know, the way I use the recipes is probably similar to you where I'll read the recipe and maybe tweak it based on what we have or other times that I've made the dish. If I know that something, you know, something works well, like if you know that nutmeg works well in the chili, you know, you're not afraid to add that to whatever recipe you've pulled up. But yeah, some of the ones you find on the internet, you can't even, there's just like no starting point to build from. You're just like, okay, well, I could have come up with something better. I could have come up with a better chili recipe off the top of my head than what what this is. Do you use, how do you feel about YouTube, the like YouTube cooking stuff?
I'm okay with it. I was going to say, I don't watch a ton on YouTube that's food related currently, but I know, like, depending on if you could trust the personality,
right,
then I'm good with it. And it's much harder to fake on YouTube.
Yeah. There's, I mean, I know there's like a whole, like, probably like back sewer of cooking stuff, but you know, if you're following the right people, I feel like they're giving, they, I get like some inspiration from YouTube, but it's probably just from like a handful of people that where I'm watching the stuff that they, they put out. The one thing that depresses me about YouTube, especially going back to our Food Network or PBS cooking shows discussion, like those shows were so delightful, where they were always felt like they were typically in like some beautiful setting. They'd like go to a market, they'd get some, they'd get some like beautiful seasonal ingredient, and then they'd like cook it in like a pretty place, and then they'd have people over to eat with them. And you know, I feel like so much on YouTube is like someone eating food by themselves in their car or like, you know, or like those cooking videos where they're just like from the top shot of the bowl and you're seeing what's happening in the pan. You're not even seeing the person's face. And I'm like, oh, this is definitely like a step down in terms of like the overall experience. Like it's, the platform has changed how the content is sent out there for food entertainment. But
yeah,
I at least do feel like there are people on there that are making good recipes that are, that we're seeing. And I still find it entertaining. Like I still, you know, I'll still watch those videos.
And it's been a little while, and YouTube is really good at feeding you what you recently have been watching or searching for. So there definitely was a stretch in the last couple of years where I was looking at like sourdough and other bread stuff. And there were some very good small creators with only whatever, a few thousand subscribers. And they did a great job where they were like, whatever, testing flour with different protein percentages, that sort of thing, or something specific. And they're doing like really awesome work, not getting a ton of views, but it's like that sort of testing and stuff. Very interesting. It takes a lot of time, takes a lot of effort. It's useful if you are facing that very specific like dilemma on like which protein or which flour to use or whatever.
Right. Yeah. No, that's just like a labor of love that someone did that and made that video, because hard to imagine that getting a million views, but for the few thousand people who find it, they're going to really appreciate that for sure.
So often I'll look at the Alton Brown books that I have, just because, like I said, very influential for both of us. And I didn't watch, as I thought back, I didn't watch the last few seasons. I just wasn't watching as much TV at that point, or Food Network or whatever. However, there's hundreds of, I think there's a couple hundred episodes. Can't quite remember, but he has four books where he puts in all the episodes plus the notes that he had, plus changes. So he sometimes didn't have enough time to prepare, or he learned new information. Yep. So he's corrected it in these books. So it must be, I mean, those are big books. It might be like 1200 pages or something like total. So I'll often reference those books. And then I also have another great reference, which I think it's the one that you also use, America's Test Kitchen.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
So that, any other favorite recipe sources? And you could talk about America's Test Kitchen a little bit too.
I don't think I had the same Alton Brown. You did. We got, I'm just here for the food, and I'm just here for more food. One was about cooking and one was about baking, but they're quite old now, but they're still, because of his approach, they're still so relevant. And then, just his approach generally, like with what you said, with updating the recipes, I found that so helpful too, because he's researched them super thoroughly the first time, but there's still stuff that he could learn. So yeah, he did a whole Good Eats Reloaded. Did you ever watch that? But he basically went back and redid 20 of his shows and was like, that's how I used to make a burger. This is now I make it this way. Things like that. And then since it's Mile High Fi, do you remember his asparagus episode at all?
I don't.
Oh, okay. It was super, I think it was like, honestly, one of his best episodes. I still remember it so vividly. He broke down like all the flavor compounds in asparagus. And he said that it's like if you pair asparagus with lemon zest and nutmeg, that gives it the same flavor notes as a Chardonnay. And whoa. Then he was like, if you do it with black pepper and roast it, it's like, I forget. It was like, that was more like a Burgundy or something like that. I was like, okay. I was like, this is mind blowing. I never thought of asparagus this way. So, and then he has one, he makes like a terrine with like farmer's cheese and it's like all pressed together. And then you cut it and the asparagus like is like in little circles, like polka dots throughout it. And I would make that for friends when they'd come over and they'd be like, so their minds would be blown, you know, they just never had anything served to them that like looks like that at someone's house. And it was like such an easy thing. It didn't even require like heating or anything like that. Interesting. So, but yeah,
trying to create
more depth to the asparagus discussion. I guess the food episode is the natural place to do that on my life.
Yeah. So, yeah, well, you could actually put asparagus in any episode and it fits. That's one thing I've learned. All right, so let's talk about equipment a little bit. And I have a couple things on my list. One is just having like really good knives. And I think most chefs, and they'll just tell you, get a really good knife, it'll be worth it. Yeah. When I first got my job, I got a Wusthof Santoku, is that how you say it?
I don't know, yeah.
It's the sort of the wider blade Asian style. And I think it's 7 inches, something like that. So got my first job.
Of course it is, Doug.
With the first, paycheck and then bought that. And that was whatever. It's like 25 years old. I probably sharpened it too aggressively, but like if you get a good one, it'll last like a really long time. And even if I'm sharpening it too aggressively, it'll still last a really long time. So that's one thing. And then I love cast iron. So I ended up with like some old antique cast iron. I think I bought it on eBay like years ago. Recently, I got a Lodge out of Tennessee. And those are great. And one little trick that I have done. So I had other cast iron, but I was like, I want more space. So I got like a 14 inch or 14 and a half. So it's big and it's kind of hard to move, but I use it all the time and it stays out because it's too big to fit anywhere. But one trick that I have learned, the cast iron is a little, it's coarse. And basically I was just like, you know what? I'm going to grind this down. So when I bought the new cast iron, I was like, and I had tested this on other pans that I had, and I'll show you when we go upstairs, but I have whatever a pan that's like 95 years old and when they used to sand it down a little bit more. So it's very smooth. Mm-hmm. And then the stuff they make now, unless you get the high end stuff, which they started to create, it's pretty rough. So I sand it down. So you end up with like a much smoother surface and it, whatever, you need a drill and a grinder. It doesn't take long to do that, but it made a huge difference and much easier to get the, seasoning to stick on there. So knife, cast iron. Yeah.
That's what I was going to ask about too, was does the seasoning stick on there the same? But yeah, sounds like you're all over that. So
Yeah.
I think, you know, especially with like equipment, like being on YouTube, you know, the Ninja Creamy is like all the like craze right now. Yeah. You just find, especially once you like learn how to cook, it's like, yeah, give me a good knife, a good cutting board, and like one good pan, and I can do 90% of what I do. And yeah, the cast iron is great. Like an actual like crock pot, not like an Instapot, is a really versatile tool. And if you have an oven and a crock pot, you can do everything you can do in an Instapot. You know, it might take a little bit more time. That is one nice thing. I mean, I guess that's backing up maybe to the advantages of early retirement, is like cooking is so fun when you have the time to do it. And it's really not fun when you're starving and have to rush. So like if you're coming home at the end of the day and you're drained and you're trying to cook, it sometimes feels, or there are often times where it felt more like a chore than like a joy. And now it's like, you know, having the time and the space to do it, it's like, it's very, very rare that I would be not enjoy it. But then if I even get in a situation where for whatever reason I am rushed, I'm like, oh, that was not fun. Definitely not worth it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm with you. Cause I remember a while back, Carl was like, oh yeah, do you have an Instapot? And I was like, no, I think I have everything covered. I'm not sure. And I looked cause people were very excited about it and air fryers too. But to your point, I'm like, I'm usually not in a rush,
right.
So I don't need to cook something fast. And I understand if people are working and whatever, kids and some, there's other constraints. But for me, I'm like, oh, it's much more fun if I'm not right. in a hurry. So most of the
like gadgets or whatever.
Yeah. Know? It's yeah. like, it just takes up more space. And I think, yeah, like with the Instapot stuff, it's like, oh, I could do it. I mean, pressure cooking is like, I think one of the things it can do, right? Yep. And I don't have a pressure cooker, and I think it can be useful at certain times, but generally like pressure cooking is an advantage because it cooks faster, right? So right. I'm like, ah, I don't care about that. On the opposite side, a lot of the stuff that I love to cook takes for fucking ever.
Right.
So like smoking a brisket, which is like pretty tough to do, but mostly because it takes a really long time right. and people are trying to do what should take 18 hours or trying to do it in 12. So they run into issues. Turns out just start it the night before and have it the dinner the next day. So I'm doing it like 24 hours at a time.
Yep.
And then you can keep it hot, but you can't speed it up once it goes in there. Are you a smoker, by the way?
Just weed. Just we are not smoking anything currently. We have like just these little wood chips that we'll put on the grill. Like it's like called a little smoker box you put wood chips in there and then it will give things like a pretty smoky flavor. The one thing I noticed though is like if you're the one actually doing the grilling, like the smoke will kind of like overwhelm your nostrils. And then when you go to eat the smoky food, you're like, oh, it didn't get any smoke. Like, and then, you know, I said that one time and everyone else was like, Rusty must have like a dead palate or something. And then I tried it the next day and I was like, oh, it was super smoky. It was just when you're getting smoke wafted up into your face for a few hours. Yeah. You lose some of that sensitivity. But I used to love to do it. That's another, I guess, early childhood memory because my dad would smoke turkey and that was like the one kind of like really like foodie thing or like gourmet thing that we had when I was a kid. When I went to live in Michigan for one summer, my dad smoked me like 8 turkeys and I like took them and put them in the freezer. Like you took all the meat off of them and put them in the freezer. And so I was like eating my dad's smoked turkey for 7 or 8 weeks straight.
That, and that smoking process works great. I fed you smoked meatloaf, right? Mm-hmm, yeah. So I made that in the kettle grill with just a smoker pack or whatever. I threw like a chunk of wood on the charcoal or something like that. Okay. Anything else on equipment or related, hardware?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good. Okay.
I have an idea for another topic though. I know we're getting close to the end. I know you've been experimenting with going out to restaurants. I don't know if you wanted to weave that into this conversation, like what your thought process is, where you're at on that journey.
So the backstory on this is we were eating in so often, maybe similar to the stats you gave before where we're eating out like once every 3 weeks or something like that. And we like eating out. It's interesting. And we also realize that if you're not going to a chain restaurant, it's like a mom and pop, it's a local business. So it's great to give your money to them versus Arby's, for example. We're going to lose the Arby's sponsorship now. I was going
to
get...
Doug and I got together and we're like, we need to get an episode out there where that gets people stopping eating at Arby's.
So we were like, hey, we should eat out a little bit more. And, you know, we move to a point where we're like, oh yeah, we have like extra money for eating out. Like we can eat out. So we haven't been doing it on any specific schedule, but it has been nice to eat out a little bit more often. Often we end up going to like breweries or a place that has beer or a tap room, something like that. So yeah, it's been good overall. And there's new restaurants popping up all the time. The thing that we're running into is we have a very good routine and we really enjoy it. We enjoy our house and we enjoy the kitchen and eating out. Even if we're obviously not doing the cooking and cleaning, it's still somewhat of a hassle, an air quote. Yeah. So it's just like, it's easier for us to cook and eat at home and it'll probably be healthier and that sort of thing. So yeah, that's kind of where we're at. It's sort of like maybe something we should spend some effort on again and be thoughtful about it. I do know we're traveling over the holiday season, so we'll be out of town for a little stretch. So I'm sure we'll be back in Atlanta. So we'll probably eat at some restaurants that are like cool and local out there. But that said, do you have any tips for us since we kind of ran into, we're going to do this. And then we just haven't been going as often.
No, I think pretty similar. We're pretty similar to what you are. Although we do find that especially when you're like traveling, getting exposure to the new restaurants, like that's that, like when people talk about local businesses, it's like a lot of times it's, food, it's breweries. Those are kind of the big categories that you can like go out and support. And it's neat that like every place you go has something different to offer. I guess this is all a long way of saying, like, I feel like the travel and eating out is a nice way of getting exposed to some new food, some new ideas. And so we find that actually does add a good amount. And then especially like if we can get a style of food that we don't cook a lot at home, those are really fun. Like we don't cook a lot of Indian food, and there's like a billion Indian restaurants in Colorado, it feels like. So that's a really fun thing for us to do. I feel like the fact that we're getting exposure to something we wouldn't normally eat kind of helps add a little bit of like richness to our lives and helps us enjoy the experience a little bit more. And they're typically just like super locally owned businesses, like especially a lot of the ethnic restaurants are like the family is like working there and you feel really good about supporting them. Like totally. Almost like they had you over for a meal at their house. So
very good. Yeah. Quick. You reminded me with the mention of the Indian food. Some of our friends have like an Indian potluck style kind of thing. Shout out to Van and Eric. And I phoned it in, but you helped me on this. I phoned it in that I bought like pre-made cookies, but I wanted to bring something that there were a lot of savory, like everything was covered. So I was like, I want to do something different. And I was like, I think snickerdoodles will go good with curry. So I basically made icing for the snickerdoodle. So I just put like curry and some other things in butter and then put it on top of snickerdoodles. It turned out awesome.
Yeah.
A lot of people really loved it.
Yeah.
Literally, they were just like straight off the shelf from Walmart. I mean, like they were homemade at Walmart. I mean, I didn't.
But you made them. You tied them into the theme, and correct. Yeah. Made them Indian, and that's not a dish that probably people have had before. Is Indian spice cookies, so.
Right? Yeah, and the thing is, I was just curious if it was like an original idea. I couldn't find any reference online to any, even the horrible recipe sites. Yeah. No one did this, and it turned out great. I was surprised that it turned out okay. And you helped me hone it in.
Test it.
We talked about the idea. So you have a byline on this as well.
I'll just take an acknowledgement at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
When you put together your cookbook. Yeah.
All right. I think we covered all the stuff we wanted to. Anything else on your mind?
No. I mean, yeah. Okay. We could probably keep going for another 5 hours, but then we wouldn't be able to eat. So,
all right. So, Rusty, you're a part-time co-host now, and up until this point, I just told people to not bother you. But you're treating this as a pro, so you have a way for people to reach out to you.
I do. I felt a little guilty about having all my emails go through Doug, so I created an email address that's rusty from co. So rusty, from like to and from, and then clikecolorado@gmail.com. So if people want to email me directly and not just make Doug be the middleman, I'll do that. I'm going to be on another podcast that you set up for me.
So, oh yeah.
So we're going to record that, I think, next week. But yeah, so very now cool. I'm like multi-podcasts, like
going around.
Yeah.
You just show up, yeah, and then other people put it out for you. Okay, yeah. So we'll write the email in the description so you could reach out to Rusty if you want to. And thanks, always fun. I think if we want to, we'll do food episodes each time. Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. I've been doing some DIY projects on my guitars, and it's been challenging, but I'll explain what I've done, and then you could ask me some follow-up questions. So as listeners know, I've been accumulating guitars, which is really fun. I've typically purchased, I think, like, we'll say like 90% of them used. So you don't get the big depreciation. And I watch a lot of YouTube, and I mean, somewhat consumerism. Like I'm getting caught up, and I'm like, oh yeah, like maybe I should upgrade the pickups in my guitar, which is perfectly fine. And which is exactly what happened. I had a fine guitar, sounds great, happy with it. People are like, that's a cool guitar, sounds good. And I thought, why don't I take everything electronic out of there and then try to hook it up myself? Now, it seems like a bad idea because it was working perfectly fine, but I did upgrade the pickup. So for people that are watching, it's a Gibson Les Paul. It's a tribute model, which is kind of the lower end, but I kind of like the way it looks. So it has it's like a honey sunburst type finish, and I got Slash signature pickups, and I had some issues. So I'll jump into it. I did essentially remove all the electronics and replaced it with more like vintage correct is what people would say. So it's like the kind of wiring and stuff that you would have in the 50s and 60s. So I went online, ordered some stuff, hooked it up, and then didn't work. It didn't work. And I was a little disappointed. The other thing that I'll add in here is I have a computer engineering degree, and I actually, my electives were a bit of a mess. If somebody looked at it, they would not understand why I put those classes together. It was what I liked. So I actually took a lot of electrical engineering classes and a lot of labs, a lot of analog circuit design. I was actually pretty good at it. And I spent a lot of time in the lab sniffing lead solder as I was working on projects.
That explains a lot.
Yeah, actually, yeah, exactly how I got here. So I haven't picked up a soldering iron in 20 years or so until the last couple of weeks. So anyway, I was working on this project and thought it was going to take a couple few hours longer than it would take a normal, like a person that does this often. And then I was down here for, I don't know, 8 hours. I would like popped up and would give Elizabeth an update, frantic. I'm like, oh no, it's not working. So anyway, I'll pause there. and let you ask some questions.
Well, I think the first one is obvious. Is do you sound like Slash now when you play the new guitar?
Unfortunately, not yet. And you hear that often. It's like, oh, yeah, I got, it's set up just like Slash would, same strings, whatever. Unfortunately, it sounds exactly like me before.
It just probably need a few more tweaks to the guitar. That's, yeah.
The hair.
It's the hair.
The hat.
Yeah. Is this going to be a new hobby for you, the working on the guitars? Did you enjoy it? Sounds like there's a little frustration there with the getting it all hooked up and then the part being faulty, but...
Yes, I think so. And while I was accumulating and ordering the parts for the first thing, or for the first guitar, I ordered parts for the other guitar because I was like, oh, I could upgrade the pickups. And they're all... While they're similar looking guitars, they are, the wood's a little bit different. And then the pickups make a huge difference in the sound. So I'm like getting guitars that will sound different for the guitarist out there. You might know that Slash usually plays in like slightly detuned. So it's not E standard, it's E flat. So I'm like, oh, that guitar will stay in E flat. I have another one where I play slide. So the action's a little bit higher. So everything's intentional for the whatever upcoming tour that I'm apparently going on.
Or the new like guitar repair business that you're going to start running out of the basement down here.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Do you find like the guitar working? Is it like, some people describe woodworking as like kind of meditative, or was it just like you were frustrated because it wasn't going well?
Definitely meditative. It was because I didn't know it wasn't going to work out until, you hook it up and then I'm like, oops. So I mentioned to you earlier, there is a point around some of this. So one, I do enjoy it. And there are some kits out there where you can get like essentially the parts and then you glue a couple things together, you wire it up, put the tuners, the electronics and that sort of thing. And you finish the guitar. And I was like, oh, that actually seems like a little step beyond what I can do, but within reach. And that sounds like a fun thing to work on. And I certainly need more guitars, of course. So
are you at 9? Last time I checked it, you were at 9. Is that
the count? Okay. I think that's 9, but we're up one amp. So it's like they're multiplying over there. Okay. It's like a little baby.
Got the amps have to keep up with the guitars. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a whole other thing. Yeah. Super fun. And you did mention it. What I determined was I think there were faulty parts. So I mean, there's only a few wires, and this whole show won't be about this. So I need to, of course, move on. There's only a few wires you could check to see if you're grounding out and just common issues. But it's been a few years since I've been debugging things, especially with like circuit design, and frustrating while you're working on it. But as you solve the problems, it's very rewarding, especially I'm like, oh yeah, like I fixed the guitar. And it actually gives you confidence to like do other stuff because you're like, oh, I fucked it up before. But it turns out like there's only a few wires. So there's only a few things that can actually go wrong. What I determined, and I would wake up in the middle of the night, start debugging the circuit in my mind.
In a cold sweat, just,
And
how can I sleep while that guitar is taken apart and not put together? What guitar am I going to play? I only have 8 now.
Do? Yeah. Luckily, there's backups for the backups. So I figured out, fairly straightforward, but I tried to figure out how to isolate different parts to find out what was faulty. Because at first I was like, oh, there's nothing faulty. But then as time went on, I was like, well, nothing I did is messed up. Nothing shorting out. I actually talked to a friend around here who has done some similar work. He's like, he was a proper double E and like did electrical engineering work. So when I asked him, he was like, nah, just check the stuff that we talked about. But I do need to get back to him and say like, hey, it was a faulty pot. And he's like, ah, so now I know. Like one, you could take certain pieces out of the circuit, and then if it works, then you know that piece was faulty. So all that to say, I have AI is so hot. Everybody is just so excited about AI. I've had issues just like, I was like, oh, what size nut is on this guitar? And it gave me like the wrong info. So I stopped using AI overviews because it was just like, so faulty. So, so yeah, I'm just like, this is totally useless. And knowing where the information came from, which is like Reddit and a bunch of other places on the internet where people may or may not know what's going on. Anyway, all that to say, I have talked to people where they're like, I'm using AI all the time, especially in my old online industry. They're like, I use AI constantly, blah, blah, blah. Their brains are getting dumber. They're just, they're not critically. So anyway, this was an eye opener because I've stopped using it as much. And then I stopped using it when I should be able to solve the problem. And this was a perfect example because I was like, oh, how can I debug this? Just over time, my brain figured it out. So now I'm smarter. I'm like, oh yeah, I need to work on these kind of problems. Anyway, any thoughts on that?
Well, you found an AI safe industry. I feel like that's kind of, you know, that's what people are looking for right now.
Yeah. So
AI made it, took a hit to the SEO stuff, but the guitar repair, you know, you found the perfect pivot.
I'll make custom guitars. Yeah. Okay. Perfect. I could do 3 hours on this.